stands in the middle of the large room, bewildered, his voice echoing off the polished floor and high ceilings. He is worked up now, frantic.
And the Standard? What about all my friends on board? Will we go yachting anymore?
No, Father says.
There is a finality in his tone that silences my brother.
We will never see the Standard again. It doesn't belong to us now.
Alexei slumps back into the chair, crestfallen.
But who is going to be Tsar now?
No one.
But if there isn't a Tsar, who will govern Russia?
Father grimaces.
You just met him.
Chapter 5. Anna. At the movies in Paris. 1968, 1958, 1955. Paris, France. July 27th, 1968. Anna can feel the entire city of Paris inhale as she stands on the Pont Alexandre III, at the highest point of its arch overlooking the Seine. The air is perfect, neither hot nor cold, but balmy and pleasant, a gift at the midpoint of this long summer. She can smell the river, fragrant like wet rocks and green grass. The scent of freshly baked bread wafts up from the cafes that line the streets on either side. It is not yet 7 o'clock, but the sun is up, and she can feel its warmth on the back of her neck. Anna closes her eyes and drinks it in. Her chaperone will find her before long, and then she will be forced to deal with today's task. Prince Frederick is no doubt frantically searching the suite at this very moment, chiding himself for giving her a key and a room of her own. But she doesn't care. She's in her early 70s, not a child in need of babysitting. Anna wants a moment to herself, a bit of silence and tranquility. He is the one who insisted she come. If she has to be in Paris, she will enjoy it on her own terms and in the ways that have always brought her pleasure. Anna saw this bridge from the balcony of her hotel room at La Maison Champs-Élysées last night and made up her mind to visit. It is broad and ornate, boasting pillars topped with gilded winged horses. 4 lanes of traffic consume the middle, but on either side are well-lit sidewalks that allow breathtaking views of the Eiffel Tower. It is nothing like that drab bridge she remembers in Berlin, and she has no plans to pitch herself over the side today. Frederick does not know this, of course, but he's been worried about her since the court in Hamburg decided her case earlier in the year. She hears the panic in his voice now as he calls her name.
Anna?
She turns to find him 10 feet away, his hand out, dismay written across his face. Frederick looks every inch the aristocrat, tall and lean, perfectly groomed, and with the sort of cheekbones that could cut glass. His eyes are grey, his hair, once black, is now sprinkled with silver, and his chin is strong. He's the sort of man who walks in a room and demands attention just by his presence. Even those who pass him on the bridge look twice, curious about him. What are you doing here?
I've come to collect you. It's time to get ready for your appointment.
He has pulled the car over and parked it a good 20 feet away. He stands there, scowling. My appointment isn't until 10 o'clock. Can't a woman take a walk and get a breakfast in peace?
You didn't leave a note. I was worried.
You needn't be. Frederick gives her a tight-lipped smile of reassurance, and then he tries to distract her.
Dominique bought you a new dress. She sent me to find you. She wants to make sure it fits.
Is she a seamstress now, too, in addition to being a journalist? Anna hates it when they coddle her. She's old, not senile, but she relents and follows him back to the waiting car. Moments later, Frederick helps her out of the vehicle and shuffles her up to the room, where Dominique waits with a smart-looking knee-length print dress. It is cream with small black roses and shiny black buttons up the front.
I couldn't help myself, Dominique says, holding up a pair of pumps and a small hat with a tiny black veil as well.
Dominique Auclair was assigned to cover Anna's first trial for Figaro, one of Paris's most prominent newspapers, in 1958.
The hardest part, she said later, was writing the facts and not my opinion. I was convinced you were Anastasia from the start. Convinced, loyal, and for a French woman, surprisingly easy to make friends with. 10 years later, Dominique is still one of Anna's closest confidants, and insisted on seeing Anna the moment she learned they were coming to Paris. Then, when she heard the reason for their visit, she insisted on tagging along for the appointment as well.
You didn't have to buy me a dress.
I didn't, in fact. It belonged to my mother. You are about the same size. I thought it would look lovely on you, and I hate the idea of it sitting in her closet getting eaten by moths.
I didn't realize she'd passed on. I'm sorry.
Don't be. She's very much alive. Mother has run off with some bohemian to Switzerland. They're living in a nudist colony near a hot springs, and she's left me to deal with her belongings.
Again.
Dominique offers a weary sigh and blows a piece of hair away from her face.
It is so difficult to raise our parents, no?
I'm the wrong person to ask.
Ah, of course. I forgot. Now it's my turn to apologize.
She kisses both of Anna's cheeks, then tugs at the sleeve of her worn and ragged dress.
Truth be told, I probably would have bought you one anyway. How long have you had this?
A long time.
Well, we certainly can't let you go meet with a film producer in this tatty old rag, can we? Appearances are everything.
Anna has known many women through the years who spouted this mantra, Dominique chief among them. But perhaps because she is French and cannot help it, Anna isn't put off when her friend recites it in her throaty, rich voice. Dominique is the classic French woman, slender and beautiful and cultured. She is brunette with striking, large brown eyes and a wide smile. She moves with grace and purpose, and is one of those women who wears off-the-shoulder sweaters in the dead of winter, and who inevitably finds herself in extraordinary circumstances without even trying. At the age of 19, she marched into the apartment of famed Austrian novelist Arthur Schnitzler and asked if she could translate all his works into French. The poor man was so taken aback by the request, and, Anna suspects, staggered by her beauty, that he agreed. It is unlikely that Dominique even needs her job at the newspaper, because she has held the copyright to Schnitzler's work in France ever since. Her profile soared after that, with her coverage of Anna's case for Figaro over the last decade comprising only a small portion of her career. And so Anna wears the dress and allows Dominique to curl and set her hair. She rejects the use of makeup outright, but does submit to wearing a necklace and bracelet. Frederick is impressed, smiling and complimenting her appearance as he leads her to the lobby. She waits a moment while he pulls the car around, and she takes one long glance at herself in a mirror hung between two light sconces. Anna has forgotten what it feels like to be pretty, to have the attention of men. And she knows that she isn't exactly pretty now, not in the traditional sense. Time and scars and trials have all taken their toll. But she does look nice, put together even, and this gives her a bit of needed courage. Gilbert Proutot greets them at the door to his studio.
Come in, the tall Frenchman bellows, sweeping his arm wide.
He has the look of a man who was recently handsome but doesn't know what to do with himself now that he's turned the corner of bald and portly. He clasps Anna's small hands in his larger ones and grins, kissing each of her cheeks in that carefree, elegant French way.
I am so glad to finally meet you, and,
he pauses to give her a look of solidarity,
for what it's worth, I think the Amberg verdict was a grave miscarriage of justice. That's why I want to make the film, to set things right in the public eye.
Chances are she will never see this man again, so she doesn't bother trying to learn his name. Anna decides he will simply be the producer. She shakes the one hand that remains around hers.
Thank you, but I must say I'm surprised you invited me. None of the others asked my permission first.
The producer has the good grace to flush a little at this. He clears his throat.
Let's refer to it as your blessing. It is my hope that the film will be in production soon.
Of course he has gone ahead anyway. Filmmakers can't seem to help themselves. On the phone you referred to it as a documentary.
It is, but the large parts will be reenactments.
He takes a step back into the large, elegant room. The spacious studio takes up the entire top floor of an office building facing the Avenue des Champs-Élysées in Paris's 8th arrondissement. At this height she can see swathes of the entire tree-lined avenue and the imposing Arc de Triomphe at its western end. One entire wall is floor-to-ceiling windows that let in copious amounts of natural light. The floors are wide planked wood, and the walls are bone-coloured plaster.
But where are my manners? Please come in. Look around. We plan to film all the court scenes here.
Frederick and Dominique follow them into the room and remain quiet as the producer gives a lengthy tour of the studio and introduces them to a few key staff who work out of the space. After showing them a series of possible set designs, the producer says,
I simply cannot believe they ruled against you.
We have already filed an appeal,
Prince Frederick says, and casts a sideways glance in Anna's direction. Her friends keep discussion of this subject to a minimum for fear she will become depressive again. She reached a low point after the court in Hamburg offered its verdict several months earlier.
There is still hope.
Good news! The film should be ready by then.
He pats a large stack of papers.
Here is the script. The structure is quite ingenious, I think. We've created a fictional premise in which two attorneys argue your case before the World Court at The Hague.
He slaps the pile in excitement.
Vittorio De Sica and Paul Meurice have already signed on for the roles. Isn't that fantastic?
Yes, this is a bonne nouvelle,
Dominique says, her voice dripping with suspicion. The producer is too wrapped up in his vision to note her tone.
We aim to dramatize your story while keeping a faithful record of the actual witness testimony. When the world sees it, they will know how poorly you were treated. They will demand justice. The Meyer testimony in particular is a non-perjury.
Anna stiffens at the mention of the charming Austrian, who gleefully upturned her case.
I appreciate your support, Anna says.
It's her standard non-committal answer, the thing she says when she doesn't know how to receive a kindness. Now, the producer claps his hands together with a loud crack, and the sound echoes off the high ceiling.
I have a surprise for you. Please, come with me to the screening room.
Frederick and Dominique exchange a concerned look, but do not question him. They all follow him to the back of the studio, and into a room with thick carpet and 8 stuffed, velvet-covered chairs. A large canvas screen covers one wall, and a projector sits opposite.
Have a seat,
the producer says. Anna lowers herself slowly into the chair nearest the door.
You said the production has not yet begun on the film.
It hasn't. This is something else, my gift to you. Something I found in the archives while doing research. I plan to include it in our film.
Ours, as though she has any say in the matter. The producer's assistant comes in while everyone else chooses a seat. He fiddles with the projector, and soon there is a whirring and clicking behind her, and faint images fly onto the screen. It's only when he turns out the light that Anna sees the grainy black and white images that flicker and then come to life. On the screen, Tsar Nicholas II walks into view with Empress Alexandra on his arm. They are laughing soundlessly at someone behind them and moving in that quick, jerky fashion that is common in old newsreel footage. Then Tsarevich Alexei skips into the frame, a mere toddler, and Anna gasps loudly, her hand going to her heart. She can see Dominique out of the corner of her eye, rising as though she will come to assist Anna. But Frederick puts a hand to her arm, and she settles into her chair again. One by one, the 3 oldest Romanov girls enter the frame, and even after all this time on splotchy film in black and white, they are breathtaking in their court dresses and wide-brimmed bonnets. They are in their mid-teens, slender and youthful. Each of them is escorted down the tree-lined avenue by a handsome cavalier.
The girls are smiling, bright and vivacious, and Anna leans forward as though she could touch them, as though she could step through the frame herself and disappear into the past. It takes her a moment to state the obvious.
"Where am I?" Anna says. "I know I was there."
No sooner are the words out of her mouth than a little girl runs up behind her sisters, frantic, hair wild, hat blown off and attached only by a ribbon knotted beneath her chin. There appears to be a smudge of dirt on her chin and bruises on her knees. Soundlessly, her father laughs, then scoops her up, planting a sloppy kiss on her cheek. The look on little Anastasia Romanov's face is one of peace and delight. It is the look of a child who is loved and secure and completely free of pain and fear. When Anna speaks, her voice is clear and calm, without a tremor.
"This was the tercentenary of the Romanovs in Moscow."
She pauses for a moment.
"I remember everything about that day." It is cruel, really, how the producer set her up. Because seconds later, the shot changes to a clip of soldiers storming the Winter Palace. One moment, the family laughs together, and the next, there is revolution.
There is a commotion at the front of the room as Frederick and Dominique chastise the producer. They are indignant that he would show her this clip without warning or permission. They demand he offer an apology, while he insists no wrongdoing. Anna hears all of this, but pays it little mind, because when she stands to leave the room, she finds that the producer's assistant has been filming her reaction to the footage. This visit was a setup. They lured her here to get a tawdry clip they could add to their ridiculous film. They are charlatans, like all the others. When her hands stop shaking, Anna faces the producer.
"You do not have my permission to use the footage you just shot. Do you understand? Not in your film, not ever."
"I think you have misconstrued."
"I will sign no papers. I will take no part in this. Not today. Not at any point. And if I find out you have violated my wishes, you will be contacted directly by my attorneys."
"Please, I beg you to reconsider."
Dominique is cursing beneath her breath, an eye-raising amount of profanity from such a pretty mouth, and Frederick looks as though he has eaten something rotten. The two of them are angry and appalled, ashamed, as though this were their fault somehow. And perhaps it is, Anna thinks. They should have known better. They should not have insisted she come.
"I am tired of being exploited," Anna says, and then walks from the studio.
10 years earlier. The High Court of Hamburg, Germany. March 30th, 1958.
"I don't know what else they want," Anna screams. "Haven't I given them everything they've asked for?"
She feels like a toddler throwing a fit. Still, she cannot help herself. Overcome with exhaustion and fury, Anna grabs the closest thing she can find and throws it at Prince Frederick. He ducks as the small leather-bound journal goes sailing past his head. It hits the wall with a wet clapping sound, then drops to the floor, its pages fluttering open to some diary entry that Anna has abandoned after half a page. Her handwriting is jittery, so is her voice. They're standing in a sparse conference room in the 24th chamber for civil cases in the High Court of Hamburg, and Frederick has just told her that the court has asked for more evidence. She is well over 50 years old, yet he insists on treating her like a child. His voice has the pained, gentle tone of a frustrated parent.
"They need more photographs of you as a young child."
"How, pray tell, am I supposed to get those? They're in Russia, for God's sake, with the rest of my family's things, assuming they haven't been burned or stolen or pillaged like everything else."
She does not tell him about the photo album hidden in her dacha. There is only one other person who knows about its contents, and neither of them can present it as evidence to the courts without jeopardizing her case at large. Judges tend to frown upon withheld evidence.
"They want handwriting specimens,"
Frederick continues calmly, and nearer proof of your relationship to the witnesses. They want every document we have that might give bearing on the case.
We gave it all to them, years and years ago. I wrote pages for them, even went to all that trouble to have my ear photographed. My ear, of all things.
Anna runs out of steam and drops to the nearest chair. Frederick squats down in front of her. She is so small that they are nearly eye to eye.
You know it was all lost during the war when your lawyer's office was bombed in Berlin.
No, no, she protests. There was more. He had more stored at another building.
That too was lost.
How is that possible?
The Central District Court was in the Soviet sector of the city afterwards. Whatever evidence that could have supported your case has long since been destroyed. All of the original exhibits are gone. We have to do this over again. We have no choice. Not if you want this to be over. Not if you want to move on with your life. You do want that, right? Please tell me you want that. Please tell me this isn't a game to you. We're all too damn old for games. Anna isn't ready to give up yet. She doesn't want to go through this whole routine again.
Annette Fallows has everything. All of Edward's files. He kept meticulous copies. Maybe we can...
Stop.
Annette hates you. You know this. She hasn't gotten over what happened. Edward's death was not my fault. Am I to be blamed for everything?
She doesn't hate you for her father's death. She hates you because Edward Fallows gave everything he owned, his entire estate, to advance your case, and she was left to pay his debts. Annette is only now piecing her life back together. It's been years since Anna allowed herself to feel guilty for the overwhelming sacrifice of her first attorney. She never asked him to spend his fortune in her defense and condemn his wife and daughter to poverty.
Perhaps if I speak with her myself...
No.
We cannot go to her again. We have to do this the hard way.
Frederick pinches the narrow stretch of bone between his eyes again. He's been doing this all morning. The bridge of his nose will be bruised if he keeps at it much longer. Anna snorts.
I didn't realize there was a way other than hard.
It is raining in Hamburg, a blistering, angry deluge that lashes the courthouse and makes the wind scream in outrage as it swirls below the eaves. Anna knew she shouldn't have come. She knew better than to let Frederick talk her into this.
I want to go home, she finally says. I'll take you home, but please come to the courtroom first. At least listen to Pierre Gilliard's testimony.
Why? So I can be tormented by yet another traitor?
He's not a traitor, Anna. He's old. And he's confused. He suffered too.
I am not Christ. I cannot bear my own suffering, much less his.
Then come and learn. His testimony will give us an idea of how this case will go. We'll know what tactic to try next.
Who is that woman in the front row?
Anna whispers, pointing at a gorgeous brunette seated right behind the prosecution. She's wearing a black cashmere sweater, a pencil skirt, and lipstick the colour of crushed raspberries. There's a notepad on her lap and a devious grin on her face. Even from this distance, she looks both formidable and provocative. Ah, to be French, Anna thinks. They are sitting in the far corner of the upper balcony, partially hidden behind a large granite column. There are only a handful of people on the second level, and none of them pay attention to the small, fine-boned woman and her well-tailored companion. Instead, they're watching the clamour below. The courtroom is filled with press and busybodies, scandalmongers and tabloid photographers, European royalty, and a pack of distant Romanov relatives led by Dmitri Leuchtenberg. He sits in the second row, looking smug. All of these spectators want to be as close to the action as possible, and are crammed into the seats below, shoulder to shoulder. Frederick telegrammed the court a week earlier, letting them know that Anna would not be in attendance. So no one is watching for her. No one notices her at all. It is the only way she can relax enough to focus on the proceedings. Anna hates photographers. She hates cameras pointed at her and the bright, startling snap of a flashbulb. But most of all, she hates giving statements to the press. They always want to know how she feels, and she always wants to poke them in the eye with a freshly sharpened pencil. That, Prince Frederick says, in answer to her question, his voice dripping with appreciation, is Dominique Auclair. She's a reporter with Figaro. I hear she's very good, very thorough. Anna snorts, thorough. Is that what they're calling it these days? Is it common to have three judges presiding over a case? She asks, nodding toward the bench, where an alarmingly young blonde woman in jurist's robes sits between two older scowling gentlemen. Frederick gives her the side eye. This is a tribunal, Anna. Judge and jury all at once. That one in the middle looks like a pin-up girl. She doesn't seem old enough to have finished university, much less sit a bench. That is Judge Reiser, and she is far older than she looks, far more frightening as well. She is considered to have one of the best legal minds in Germany, he says, then adds, whatever you do, don't piss her off. That woman is your best hope of a favorable verdict. But she also loves a good courtroom tussle and is known to change her opinions without warning. And the others? Equally dangerous, more conventional, but less testy. Age has mellowed them a bit. He points to each of the men, Werkmeister and Barkham. Now that Anna has resigned herself to watch the proceedings, her sense of humor has returned. Do you know what the press is calling this? The trial of doubt and coincidence, and the lawsuit of ghosts. Ignore them. Difficult, given that they use the front pages of their newspapers to scream at me. She points to the man sitting at the defendant's table. And, of course, there's Gilliard, more than willing to give them fodder. They only called him because he wrote that damnable book. Remember, Gilliard does not represent the imperial family. He speaks for himself. Don't be too hard on him, Anna. Few of us wouldn't do the same if a gun were placed to our heads. Anna's eyes have grown lighter with age, but they are still a crisp and penetrating blue. Must we speak of guns today? The session is called to order, and the crowd whispers now instead of shouting across the room. All eyes are turned toward the front, where Judge Werkmeister, president of the Hamburg Tribunal, calls Pierre Gilliard forward to give his testimony. The famed Romanov tutor is showing his age. 78 years old, with silver hair and bad joints, he moves slowly to the bar, wearing a dark suit and obvious disdain. In his hands is a copy of his book, The False Anastasia, and he grips it like a life preserver. Anna studies her fingernails, while the judges go through the preliminary questions. She knows all these answers, has heard them for years. Pierre Gilliard was tutor to the imperial family. He served them for over a decade, and he went into exile with them after the revolution. Gilliard accompanied the family right up to the train station in Ekaterinburg, and was one of the last people to see them all alive. He has denounced Anna's claim to the rights and title of Anastasia Romanov since he met with her in Berlin in 1925. That encounter is documented in great detail in his book, but no one knows about their second meeting in 1954. He has chosen not to publish those details. Anna returns her attention to the bench when she hears Gilliard speaking, and she realizes she has missed a question from the judges. The intimates of the Russian court have been categorical on this subject, Gilliard says. None of them could find the slightest resemblance between that woman and Anastasia Romanov. Not a single one of them. Judge Werkmeister drops his chin and raises his eyebrows, looking like a dubious turkey. How do you know that? He asks.
They have told me 100 times.
100 times? The judge asks. This is not a classroom, and we have not invited you here to give lessons on hyperbole.
I remind you, Herr Gilliard, that you must be ready to swear to what you say.
Anna has always found it odd that in German courtrooms, the witness is only sworn in after giving testimony, and usually only if the testimony is considered highly relevant, or if the justices are trying to catch a witness perjuring himself.
Gilliard clears his throat and straightens his spine.
If I said 100 times, I meant many times. As for Anastasia's own aunt, she issued a peremptory declaration to the Danish newspapers. That can be easily verified, as it is part of the official record.
Again, I remind you that, as a witness, we have called you here to tell us only what you yourself have seen and experienced.
The old tutor sighs, and Anna cannot help but smile. She has always found that teachers are the least teachable of all people. Pierre Gilliard has to restrain himself from lecturing the judges as they continue with a relentless series of questions. Judge Reiser is the hardest on him. She wants to know specifics of his meeting with Anna in 1925. Where they met, what time of day it was, how long they spoke. Anna decides she likes Reiser immensely when she asks Gilliard if he can remember what Anna wore that day. He looks dumbfounded at the question.
What she wore? I don't have the slightest idea. Why is that important?
Because, Judge Reiser smiles sweetly, you say in your book that you performed a thorough investigation.
I did.
Then you should remember all of those details. They were enough to convince you that the plaintiff is not Grand Duchess Anastasia.
But her clothing has nothing to do with that.
Pierre Gilliard nearly growls through his clenched jaw when he speaks again.
I wrote my book so that I would not have to remember the details. I cannot recall them any more.
Judge Bakken has been content to listen until this point, but he speaks now, dryly. Ordinarily, a witness who knows that he is going to be heard finds a way to freshen his memory. Gilliard lifts his book and shakes it before the judges.
Monsieur le Président, he says, voice trembling, I wrote this 35 years ago, and I can swear that everything in it is true.
A book is not evidence, Herr Gilliard, Judge Bakken says. He doesn't blink or show the slightest bit of emotion.
Anna cannot, for the life of her, decipher what he's thinking.
Judge Reiser adjusts her robe, pulling the collar away from her neck so it doesn't chafe.
Your account of those events is of little interest to the court. We would, however, love to see your original documentation. You cite it thoroughly in your book. Of particular interest are a series of letters you say your wife, Shura Tegleva, received from the Empress's sister. You place great weight on them, given that she was a governess in the Romanov household.
Not just a governess, he says. Anastasia's governess.
Frederick leans toward Anna and whispers in her ear.
Shura died 3 years ago. Pierre hasn't been the same since.
Judge Reiser continues.
It was these letters that first convinced you to meet with Anastasia in Berlin, yes?
Yes, but I met with Anna Anderson, not Anastasia, he stresses.
I want to see your correspondence with the Duke of Lichtenberg, and also the entirety of your written exchanges with Harriet von Rathleff, one of the plaintiff's first supporters. You state in your book it was these conversations that led you with certainty to believe that she is not Anastasia Romanov.
The judge points to the book in Gilliard's hands. He is now grasping it to his chest and stroking as though about to swear on the Bible.
In your book, the false Anastasia, you published photographs and handwriting samples, but the court has not been granted access to any of the original documents. Will you make them available?
No, Pierre Gilliard says resolutely.
There is a good 10 seconds of stunned silence in the courtroom before he explains himself.
I do not have them anymore.
Why not?
I destroyed the entire dossier after the last court ruled against her. I thought the case was closed.
I didn't think I needed to keep my research any longer.
Judge Rice's voice is a low, dangerous purr. What did you do with those documents?
I burned them.
A historian who burns his archives, she says, bending over the bench and getting as close to the withered old tutor as possible, is like a corpse that stinks.
I can look, he says, desperate. Perhaps there is still something left in my safe deposit box.
This witness is dismissed, Judge Werkmeister says in disgust.
Frederick is helping Anna to her feet when a lawyer for the defense rises quickly from his seat and says,
We would like to call another witness.
The tribunal looks none too pleased at this surprise, but they confer among themselves for a moment.
Who? Werkmeister asks.
His name is Hans Johann Meyer. In 1918, he was a prisoner of war being held in Ekaterinburg in the basement of the Ipatiev house. He was an eyewitness to the slaughter of the entire Romanov family and can prove definitively that Anastasia Romanov is dead.
No, 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 it can't be. I have never seen that man before, Anna says, gripping the rail and leaning forward.
She no longer cares if anyone in the courtroom discovers her presence. But again, no one is looking at her. All eyes are on the tall, bald man with perfect posture. He must be several years older than Anna, but he is aged very well and moves like a man in his 40s. As he takes his place at the bar, a spectral quiet settles over the courtroom.
Please state your name for the court, Judge Reiser says. She has the pinched look of a woman who has just been given vinegar when she thought she was getting wine.
Hans Johann Meyer.
And you are German?
Austrian.
How did an Austrian come to be a prisoner of war in Siberia in 1918?
The same way Russians, Germans, Ukrainians, and a handful of Mongolians ended up there as well. The Bolsheviks were no respecters of persons, I'm afraid. They hated everyone equally.
He smiles at the judges and then turns to the courtroom to let everyone see the grin.
Have an opinion? Rot in jail. If that wasn't their official mantra, it was certainly close to it. As for me personally, I had the great misfortune of being in Petrograd the previous October when the Bolsheviks wrested control away from the provisional government. Wrong place, wrong time, long train ride to exile.
And why were you in Petrograd to begin with? Judge Reiser asks.
Meyer sighs, and there is a wistful note to his voice.
A woman.
And just like that, he has everyone in the palm of his hand. The Austrian is handsome, funny, and well-spoken. Anna feels a pit begin to open in her stomach.
Where did they find this man? She whispers to Prince Frederick. I don't like him.
I don't know, he says, looking rather dispirited. Everything that Anna feels is being played out on her friend's face. But this isn't good. For his part, Hans Johann Meyer is a master storyteller. And the tale he spins before the court is not only compelling, but is immensely probable and peppered with enough details to be damnably believable as well. He makes no attempt to hide the fact that he has recently serialized his story in a tabloid called Seven Tage. He makes no apologies for this, but simply explains that he is only now appearing before the court because he has finally made his story public.
I was, as you can imagine, traumatized for many years.
Anna's voice is dry as dust when she says, It must have been horrible for him. He's very good. Prince Frederick growls. What's worse, he's charming. Just look at Judge Reiser. The beautiful blonde jurist is listening raptly, her lips pursed in thought, her full concentration bent on this witness. Meyer goes on to explain that once imprisoned in the Ipatiev house in Ekaterinburg, he was put to work doing menial labor. He was kept in a small room in the cellar, and it was there, he says, that the imperial family was brought on the night of July 17th, 1918. His account of what happened next is detailed and shocking. It leaves many of the journalists looking ill, dabbing at their eyes and covering their mouths. Maya describes the slow thump of footsteps descending the cellar stairs. The questions of confused children, a tired family yanked from their beds, and then silence in the cellar as their captors leave and go into an adjacent room and drink enough vodka to finish the task. Maya describes in detail and with shaking voice what gunshots sound like in an enclosed space, and how the smell of gunpowder can drift beneath a closed door. He tells of screaming and crying, and the dull thud of gunmetal hitting human flesh. The worst sound, he explains, was the silence afterward, and the knowledge of what it meant. None of that could compare to what the Bolsheviks asked him to do next, however. Hans-Johann Meyer was taken into the cellar, and told to help load the bodies onto a wagon. He tells the court how those bloodied, battered bodies lay still and mangled in death. He tells them of the iron-laced stench of blood mixed with the scent of bodily waste voided upon death. How he retched until his throat was raw and bloodied. He tells them with tears in his eyes how those sights and sounds have haunted him every day since. Maya explains to judges Reiser, Werkmeister, and Varken how desperate he was to believe that a Romanov, any Romanov, had survived the slaughter, and how he followed those soldiers into the woods. Maya waited until the soldiers left to fetch supplies so they could destroy the evidence of their grisly deeds. Only then did he creep forward. His voice is hollow when he explains that in the middle of a warm summer night, he stood in the clearing known as Pig's Meadow and counted the bodies of 7 Romanovs and 4 servants and wept because he had been unable to save any of them. "You have to understand," Maya says, turning toward his audience. "There is no one who wanted that young woman to live more than I did. That's why I went there at risk to my own life. If she had been alive, I would have helped her. But none of them survived that night. I speak the truth in this. Anastasia Romanov is gone." The gavel is a distinctly American symbol, and Anna has watched her fair share of Hollywood films in which a judge bangs his gavel to bring order or closure to the court. The gavel is not a tool used in German courts, and there is certainly none in the room today, but you can hear the pounding in her mind anyway. She knows with certainty how the judges will decide, and she is confirmed in this belief when Maya produces a single piece of evidence to support his claim, an official Bolshevik announcement of the Imperial Family's execution, which he claims to have received from the Ural Regional Soviet in Ekaterinburg and smuggled out of Russia on his release a short time after the massacre. Anna's lawyers fly into action, insisting the judges give them time to refute Meyer's account. They question his credibility and recent appearance, given that the case is decades old. They beg for more time. They demand that he be officially sworn in. The fact that her attorneys are so stunned by this new development seems to work against them. After a brief huddle, Werkmeister announces that the objections raised by the petitioner against the credibility of the witness Maya are not valid. We will hear no other witnesses in this matter. The verdict comes not days or weeks later, as Anna and Frederick expect, but that very afternoon. By the time Maya steps away from the bar, it has grown late and dark, and a cold wind howls through the streets of Hamburg, whipping the rain into little cyclones in the gutter. Frederick and Anna decide to stay the night and drive to the Black Forest the following day. They are called back to the courtroom before they've had time to collect all of their belongings from the small conference room where the day began. It is Judge Werkmeister who delivers the verdict, while Judges Reiser and Barken nod in agreement. "It is the belief of this court," Werkmeister says, "that Meyer's knowledge of these details can only have come from things he witnessed firsthand. We do not believe they were gleaned from other writings, stories, or rumors circulating at the time of these events.
It is the belief of this court that his account is true, that the entire Romanov family was murdered in 1918, and therefore we deny the petitioner's suit to be legally recognized as Anastasia Romanov.
Anna sits back, bewildered, as the judges rise from their bench and begin to adjust their robes. Bedlam overtakes the courtroom as flashbulbs go off and a din of voices erupts. Dmitri Luchtenberg looks as though he's just been declared the King of England.
I don't understand, Anna says. We can appeal. I refuse to let it end like this, Prince Frederick says.
There is metal in his voice, and his hands are wrapped around the railing like shackles. Neither of them notices the stunning brunette who settles into the chair beside Frederick until she speaks.
I think an appeal is a brilliant idea, she says.
They look at her in astonishment. Forgive me, the brunette says.
I saw you appear on the balcony when they called for a verdict. If I'd known you were here today, I would have sat with you all along.
She smiles, bright and cheerful, as though this were not, in fact, a terrible day, and sticks out her lovely, long-fingered hand in greeting.
My name is Dominique Auclair, and I would like to help with your case.
3 years earlier. Paris, France, August 1955. Ingrid Bergman is nothing like Anna thought she would be. Lovely, yes. Thin enough to make Anna cringe with envy. Glamorous, statuesque, exotic in that cool, disinterested Swedish way. All of these things, of course. But what strikes Anna most is simply how kind the woman is. They sit in her dressing room, on the set of her 20th Century Fox film, Anastasia, drinking tea and eating thin, frosted cookies that taste like pure sugar. Anna isn't going to complain, however. She still isn't sure this is actually happening. To criticize the food might spoil the illusion.
Thank you for accepting my invitation. I didn't think you would, Bergman says.
I didn't think it was real.
The actress laughs. Anna has to give her this moniker. To admit that she is sitting in a room with one of the world's most beloved actresses is too much to wrap her mind around.
What convinced you, then? Apparently not the stationery.
No, I get letters all the time. That's easy enough to fake. It was the offer of an all-expenses-paid trip to Paris. I decided to call your bluff.
The actress's smile is wide, nearly blinding.
I assure you this is no bluff.
So I see.
If Anna had actually believed this was real, she would have worn something nicer. It's probably a good thing that she assumed it was just another cruel joke, right up until the limousine pulled to a stop at her hotel, because she came as herself, and it immediately disarmed the actress.
What I don't understand is why you wanted me to come in the first place.
The actress thinks for a moment, trying to figure out how to answer. When she speaks, there's a slight accent to her voice, mellow now that she's no longer trying to sound American. The Swedish is coming through.
People think this is an easy job. They assume you just pop in front of a camera and look pretty, that you dance or laugh or cry on command. But what most people don't realize is that you have to find the character first.
She reaches out and braves a single pat of Anna's hand.
This is the first time in my career that my character can actually, literally be found, you see. You're all over the weekly papers. You have been for years. They call you the Empress of Unterlengenhardt and the Hermit of the Black Forest.
I am a Mishka for the journalists, Anna says.
The actress sounds like carbonated joy when she laughs.
You are funny.
Most people don't think so. Most people call me a liar and a fraud.
Would you like to know what they call me?
Again that bewitching smile.
Adulteress. Whore. The star who fell from heaven. I was denounced on the floor of the American Senate as being a powerful influence for evil. If I had the choice, I would prefer to be called a liar any day. I am an actress, after all.
That's what I do for a living. I lie all day long in front of the camera, and no one cares a whit. The difference, I suppose, is that I get paid for it while you get punished.
Do you think I'm lying? Anna asks.
The actress's answer to this question will determine whether she stays for the remainder of this meeting.
I don't care.
Anna blinks at her a few times. She expected a hard answer on either side, anything but ambivalence.
I realize that sounds harsh, and I apologize, but the issue of lying is irrelevant. What I want to know can't be verified by anyone but you.
And what exactly do you want to know?
What drove you off the Bendler Bridge?
Anna sets her teacup down carefully on the saucer, then places it on the small table beside her. The dressing room is spacious and bright. Soft pink walls and floor-to-ceiling windows covered in gauzy curtains. There are costumes and shoes scattered about. An entire apothecary selection of perfumes and makeup. Lamps covered with scarves to mute the light. Bottles and boxes and powders of all sorts.
It is the lair of a star. And there is Ingrid Bergman herself, wearing grey slacks and a white cashmere sweater. Her feet are bare, and there's not a stitch of makeup on her face. Her hair is pulled back and tied with a ribbon at the nape of her neck. She looks serene and comfortable in her own skin. And the only thing she wants to know is why Anna tried to kill herself. The irony of this is impossible to escape. One of the worst moments of Anna's life has become one of the most interesting things about her. Anna can't explain what makes her tell the truth. The word simply comes unbidden from her.
Despair.
The actress is neither triumphant nor pitying. She simply nods as though she expected as much.
I know what that feels like, to be disgraced, to be hated and driven to extremes, but I don't know what drove you to feel those things. And I can't make this film until I do.
She smiles briefly.
As you know, this is my return to the American screen. This is my chance at redemption, at finding my way back to who I used to be. And I realize that I have to use you to accomplish it. There are only slivers of resemblance between this fiction and your life. But it begins with you in Berlin on that bridge. You are the seed of inspiration. My character shares your name. That's why I invited you here. I need your help.
Anna can feel herself leaning forward, hypnotized by that smooth voice, eager to comply. No wonder this woman holds the world in the palm of her hand. Still, she isn't ready to acquiesce just yet.
I fear you are wrong in assuming that I know anything about your movie. What news I receive in the Black Forest is rarely accurate or on time.
The actress is genuinely surprised at this.
Oh, she says, forgive me. I often assume the entire world knows my business before I do. The story revolves around a clever young woman who has lost her memory. It is a melodrama, inspired by a play written by Marcel Moret.
Here she stops and blushes.
Mademoiselle Moret was horribly embarrassed to learn, only after her play was published, that you were still alive. She assures me that she would have consulted you otherwise.
A convenient platitude now that she has made her fortune, Anna says. But it does explain the current legal situation the producers of your film are facing, I suppose. 20th Century Fox is having to pay for her omission.
If the actress is bothered by this jab, she doesn't let on.
The legalities are not hers to worry about.
Instead, she chooses to offer Anna specifics about the film, much the way she would if giving an interview.
The story begins with a young woman on the Bendler Bridge in Berlin, ready to take her own life. She's rescued and later persuaded by three power-hungry Russian émigrés to impersonate Grand Duchess Anastasia for the purposes of swindling the Dowager Empress, the late Tsar's mother. As you know, I play Anna. But you may not have heard that Yul Brynner is playing her lover, and Helen Hayes is playing the Dowager Empress. The cast is impressive. So is the script, and I am delighted to be a part.
Principal photography is taking place in Paris, Copenhagen, and London. It is here that Ingrid Bergman looks like a small girl, delighted by her surroundings. I cannot wait to film at the Eiffel Tower and the Tivoli Gardens. You can't imagine how lovely they are. But she can imagine. Anna went to see the Eiffel Tower at sunset last night and stayed until the sky looked like black ink littered with silver confetti. Anna pulls a large envelope from her purse and slides out a single sheet of paper. It is filled with legal jargon and disclaimers. I have yet to be convinced why I should sign this waiver your studio sent. You have read it, then? Many times, Anna says. And you have objections? I object to being bought. Most people do, but I'm told that signing will earn you $30,000. That's a great deal of money. Anna looks pointedly at the actress, a woman known for her lavish lifestyle. Is it? Ingrid Bergman gives a hearty, genuine laugh. They warned me you were sharp. And no, I suppose it's not a great deal of money to someone like me. But someone like me should be grateful. No, that's not what I was going to say at all. Then what? Simply that I care not a whit about money, regardless of the amount. Spoken like a true film star. Meaning a lie? Anna studies the dressing room and notes the trappings of Ingrid Bergman's wealth. Meaning well-acted but totally disingenuous. The actress shrugs. It's a simple gesture, as though she's shaking off the insult. And that one small movement makes Anna feel a flicker of shame. Believe what you want, the actress says, but I have learned the old adage well. Money cannot buy happiness. Perhaps not, but it makes a nice down payment. Another hearty laugh, and the actress gazes at Anna with genuine fondness. How much is enough, then, if not the amount offered? It doesn't matter. My lawyers will take the lion's share regardless. You can't imagine the legal fees I've accrued through the years. Ah, I see. Don't feel sorry for me. I despise pity, Anna says. As do I. And I wouldn't insult you with it. Anna believes her. And it is only for this reason that she takes a pen from the dressing table and scrawls her name on the line at the bottom of the waiver. She hands it to the actress, matter-of-factly. Please do not portray me as a fool. I am tired of being the punchline. When the actress takes Anna's hand this time, it is with great tenderness. You have my promise. But please, I need to know your story. Tell me, I must know why you were in Berlin that night on that bridge. I need to know what you felt. So Anna tells her. The story is long and heart-wrenching, and there is silence in the dressing room afterward. She leaves Ingrid Bergman curled up in her chair like a stunned child, her eyes red, her perfect porcelain cheeks wet with tears, and a signed waiver in her hands.
Chapter 6. Anastasia. House Arrest. 1917. Alexander Palace. Saskoye Selo, Russia. April 9th. As soon as we enter the sitting garden, Alexei sees the indecent figures scrawled on the garden wall. The walled enclosure filled with willow trees, stone benches, and a large, clear reflecting pool is my favorite spot on the palace grounds. And now the guards have ruined it. They are so full of disdain for my family that they have taken to studying us, watching for the things that give us pleasure, and then systematically ruining them. I must have smiled on one of our previous visits, or made a passing comment about its beauty. A sigh would have been enough, really, to betray my feelings. The guards are several paces behind, no doubt waiting for us to discover the graffiti, positioning themselves to witness our horror.
Is that?
Alexei asks, and I follow the long, thin line of his finger to the crude phallic symbol. Dr. Botkin clamps a protective hand over his son's eyes.
Gleb has joined us in the garden today, mostly to keep Alexei company, but also because he is his father's shadow and cannot stay away for more than a day or two. The square line of Botkin's jaw goes tight, teeth clenched together as he studies.